The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Hello and welcome into hour number two of Sports Talk 1240 here at the tail end, November 11, 2014, just after 9 p.m. I am Eric Garment, back from a bit of a hiatus. Great stuff from Bill Donahue in hour number one with John Unitas Jr. and Dan Buscema. Going to get into some NFL, some MLB talk here in the second hour. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have the New York Mets beat writer for Newsday, Mark Carrig, joining the show. But coming on now to start with a little bit of Jets talk, we have Scott Salmon from SB Nation's Gang Green Nation. Scott, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well myself. So let's set up the Jets here in Week 13. Jets getting a little bit of an interesting scheduling quirk because of the displacement in Buffalo last week. Jets getting two straight Monday night games, and certainly they've just got to hope for any sort of improvement over the debacle in Detroit last week where they fell to the Buffalo Bills 38-3. And Geno Smith is going to be back in the starting saddle this week. What Rex Ryan is calling a, quote, Jets decision. There's some sort of fuzziness about that. It doesn't sound like it's coming from Rex. It could be coming from Idzik. It could be coming from Woody. What do you make of this, quote, unquote, Jets decision to put Geno Smith back in the starting role?
I honestly don't think it's really anything new. Since John Idzik has come in, they've sort of emphasized that everything is sort of a team decision. So I don't think that necessarily means that it's out of his hands. There have been some reports that it was, that he wanted to stay with Mike Vick. I don't think there's really any way to know. But I don't think that the specific language of group decision is really anything new here.
It's been a very interesting and tumultuous year for the Jets at quarterback, starting with Geno, with sort of the specter of Michael Vick looming behind. People really, when you talk about Michael Vick, they really think back to his Falcons and his Eagles days, when he was just this great, mobile quarterback. He could gun it on the run, and when he was called into action, sort of on a whim, he was just not ready, and he still hasn't shown that he is ready to play. When the Jets beat the Steelers, it wasn't really, a quarterback's game. It was just kind of a lot of mistakes by the Steelers leading to that Jets win. So is there really any sort of deeper meaning in the Jets going back to Geno, kind of replacing Vic? Do the Jets maybe think that Vic hasn't lived up to the contract that he's been given and the expectations of him? Or is it just trying to figure out if either of these guys is supposed to be the guy moving into 2015 and beyond?
So Mike Vick, obviously, like you said, he really hasn't blown anyone out of the water. However, he's, for the most part, obviously last game was not a very good game for him, but he's been, for the most part, I think, serviceable. Yeah, he's really limited his turnovers since the first Bills game. And so he really didn't knock his chance out of the park, but I also don't know that he really did an awful job. This seems to be more about Geno Smith. They just want to make, from my understanding of it, is they just want to make sure, they want to give him one last shot, make sure that he is or is not the guy going into next season. I think it's just sort of one last try for him.
So, a lot of the trouble for the Jets on offense this season has really started the quarterback position early in the year. Geno Smith, so many turnover problems. Especially in the one game, I can't remember specifically which one it was off the top of my head, but the four turnovers.
That was the first Bills game.
The first Bills game, that's right, and it was just an absolute
disaster,
absolute wreck. Yeah, about a little bit over a month ago, he just all the wheels completely fell off, got him benched, and then Mike Vick came back in. Maybe he was the savior, maybe he wasn't. Worked out a win over Pittsburgh, but overall, Vic is sort 1-3 sort of, because he got the reins for most of that Buffalo game. But who is really, is there anyone really particularly to blame for the offensive woes this season? The quarterback situation, not ideal. Running back was okay. You had Chris Ivory. He had a very promising year last year. Mm-hmm. They brought in Chris Johnson, didn't really do it. Eric Decker hasn't really made a major impact on the Jets' offense so far. Same with Percy Harvin getting thrown into the mix in the middle of the year. So is there anyone in particular that you would assess like the most blame to here?
Well, yeah. So I think the whole thing is really a team failure. But if you have to go to one person the most blame, I think it always comes down to the quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
And if Geno was playing well to start the season off, they had some close games. They against for example the Green Bay Packers, the mm-hmm. Bears. They almost came back in. They had a little bit better quarterback play, not quite as many turnovers. I think it would have been a wildly different season. So yeah. I think really, if you're looking for one person, I guess, to blame the most, then it has to match the quarterback.
I guess by just saying the quarterback, you mean the combination of Geno Smith and Michael Vick?
I'd say more Geno Smith, more, just because right. during those closer games, he was the guy.
Yeah, now you think back to that Green Bay game. The Jets were up. They were comfortably leading in that game.
Yeah.
Everyone was so surprised by it. Jets had the I think it was the 21-3 lead they were up.
Yeah, something like that.
21-3, more than halfway through the second quarter. And then right at the back end of that half, Green Bay got 13 points, completely turned it around. Jets only got one more field goal out of that game. And really, it's kind of been all downhill from there. They didn't win again until week 10 mm-hmm. after falling in Green Bay. So the Jets are basically, done for this year. They're completely eliminated from the playoff hunt. They're sort of just either winning or losing for draft position at this point. I actually had one other question regarding the quarterback mm-hmm. position. Back in 2012, in the offseason leading up to that year, that was the acquisition of Tim Tebow, while Mark
right.
Sanchez was still in place to be the starter. Is it really worth assessing any blame to Mike Tannenbaum for acquiring Tim Tebow and kind of, hiding him behind Mark Sanchez and putting that, that threat into him? Sanchez had a bad year in 2012. In the preseason in 2013, he was basically exposed to injury, opening the door for Geno Smith to play. And now we're here in 2014 with this, back and forth of Smith and Vic. So, obviously, Sanchez playing fantastic for Philadelphia mm-hmm. right now. I always personally thought that Sanchez kind of got a raw deal mm-hmm. from the Jets at the end of his time with the franchise. Is there really any blame to be placed on Mike Tannenbaum with that Tebow acquisition and setting off this whole chain of events?
Well, I think the bigger blame for that move in particular, for Tannenbaum specifically, is what it did with they lost a couple draft picks, if I remember right. It was a fourth round draft pick and a sixth round draft pick, if I remember right.
Yeah.
I think that was the bigger thing. But from the get-go, once Tebow got here and the coaches saw him practice, from my understanding of what happened, as soon as they saw him in practice, they knew he wasn't really gonna be a threat to Sanchez.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that was necessarily the problem. I think it's more of, if you want to look to, I guess, setting them events in motion, you have to go back a little bit further to 2011 when they let Braylon Edwards go.
Yep.
They let Jericho Cotchery go.
Sure.
And they sort of divested Mark Sanchez of what little weapons he had. So I think if you want to look to where the train is really set in motion, you probably have to go a little bit farther back than Tim Tebow.
Currently talking with Scott Salmon of Gang Green Nation, part of the SB Nation blog network. Talking about, you mentioned letting go of Braylon Edwards and Jericho Cotchery, taking away weapons from the offense. No matter who the quarterback is next year, whether it's Geno Smith, maybe Michael Vick, Matt Sims in sort of the nuclear option, or if it's someone that's brought in, someone that's drafted, whoever it is, are you of the mind that the Jets should utilize the control they have over Percy Harvin's contract and keep him for at least 2015 so they're not taking away potential targets for whoever may be under center next year?
I think if that's the only option to keeping him at his current contract, then yes, I think they should. But if they can at all, if it is at all possible to restructure his contract, mm-hmm. reduce the total cap a little bit, then I think that's the way they really have to go, and they really need to push Harvin on that. But if he's not willing to renegotiate, and he may not be, then, I do believe it. They have the solution here with Percy Harvin, or at least part of the solution. it doesn't make sense to get rid of him and then be back to square one.
Absolutely. And you've got guys, other guys on the roster, of course. You've got Eric Decker be on the team for a few more years. Jeremy Curley signing an extension this year. He'll be around. Very good slot receiver to have. Good guy to pair with Harvin. Jason Morrow, been dealing with a lot of injuries, but he should be improved for next year. Jeff Cumberland should still be around. He's proven himself to be a good enough receiver when needed. So in theory, it's not one of, you know, you wouldn't necessarily put it in the, not even necessarily in the top half of potential receiving core in the league, but it's not, you know, as bad as it had been or could have been for the Jets moving forward in terms of receivers for 2015 and beyond.
Absolutely. And they really haven't had this good a set of receivers since 2010. So this is something that's been sort of plaguing them for the past couple of years. It really hurt Mark Sanchez's last few years. They finally seem to have good receivers in place. That's one of the few things going into the future that I don't think the Jets are really going to have much cause to be nervous about. It's more obviously quarterback, maybe to spruce up the offensive line a little bit. Those are the real issues on the offense.
Absolutely. So, as I mentioned, the Jets season is, for all intents and purposes, done. They're sitting at, I just had it up. Where did it go? They're sitting at 2-9, heading into tomorrow night's game with Miami. What sort of a draft pick position are the Jets realistically looking at? Is there anything to really play for other than just trying to see what you've got in some guys, maybe, you know, call up a practice squad guy or two and see if there's any sort of spark there to carry you over into next year?
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people always talk about tanking. A couple of years ago, it was suck for luck.
Yep.
But the players do always, in a sense, the players and the coaches always, in a sense, have something to play for. And the coaches, it's possible they can keep something, at least some of them could keep their jobs if they get their players to perform well in the last two games, or they can keep some pride. The players, some of them are doing tryouts for their next team. Some of them are trying to stay on this team.
Yep.
So I think the players themselves, the players and the coaches themselves, they do have a lot to play for, even if it isn't necessarily a win or to try and make the playoffs, even though it's obviously impossible now. So the team does have some things to play for. There are at least the specific people on the team.
Right. So in terms of the people with the decision-making power, Rex Ryan, the general consensus among, you know, all the people in the know is that Rex Ryan's time with the Jets as the head coach is five games or less from completion. Do you agree with that sentiment?
I didn't agree until I think it was this morning when Adam Schefter came out with a report that the Jets were looking at possibly trading for Jim Harbaugh.
That's right.
And before then, I would have said, you know, if they had a couple good games to end the season, it's possible they would have kept him, because I know how much Woody Johnson loves Rex Ryan. But that's really the first concrete evidence that they're really looking at their options beyond Rex. And we've seen from a couple years ago when the Dolphins are trying to get Harbaugh, it's not really a good look to be looking for your next coach while you still have your current coach.
Right.
So I think the Jets are only doing that. Logically, it only makes sense that they're really doing that with the intention of getting rid of him.
Right, and it took a 3-1 run to end the year last year to even get Rex to come back for this year, for Woody Johnson to have enough faith in him to bring him back. But it seems fair to, assuming that Rex Ryan is not retained as the New York Jets head coach, there's then a further discussion to be had about whether or not that it's time to blow the whole thing up and reset it, and also fire John Idzik, or whether Idzik has some sort of plan that hasn't yet been realized, and it's worth keeping Idzik around and letting him sort of pick his coach and sort of set his system. But there is a lot of animosity towards John Idzik, especially after this past offseason, when a lot of issues, notably in the secondary, were not addressed. Idzik really did not seem to have a handle on the cornerback free agent market. He allowed numerous people to come into Florham Park, visit with the Jets, and then leave, and then they obviously didn't come back. The only cornerback who signed was Dimitri Patterson, and we all know how that turned out. So what would your take be? If Rex is gone, Is it also time to move on from John Idzik and reset the whole thing? New coaches, new GM, probably almost certainly in that situation a new quarterback. Or do you retain any faith in John Idzik?
I'm sort of a, I think I'm alone at this point. I retain some faith in him. I don't think he blew the offseason as bad as a lot of people think. I think if you compare the roster now to what he inherited, especially if you look at like wide receiver, for example, running back, I think it's significantly better than what he inherited. So in a lot of ways, the roster has improved. Obviously, he blew the cornerback position. That could be his what knocks him out. But I don't know that it's necessarily as bad as people are suggesting. That said, personally, I wouldn't be opposed to the Jets retaining him for another season, letting him pick his own coach. However, I think if they do replace him, they're probably going to be in the same position. We're probably going to be talking the same thing in another year or two. I think the problems that the Jets have are far deeper than John Idzik or Rex Ryan.
Sure.
It really goes to the core of the front office. So unless the team is truly serious about blowing it up, and by that I mean blowing up the entire front office,
mm-hmm.
a lot of these people that have been there for 10, 15 years,
right.
I think we're probably going to be having the same conversation in a couple of years anyway.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Jim Harbaugh thing, and San Francisco is mm-hmm. open to trading him, not unlike who is it? I can't think of his name right now. He does the Monday Night Football.
John Gruden was traded.
John Gruden.
Bill Belichick was technically traded from the Jets.
That's right, yeah. So if Jim Harbaugh were to be traded, and he were to be traded to the Jets, what is the possibility or probability that, A, Harbaugh would ask for that decision-making job, basically ask for John Idzik's job in addition to Rex Ryan's job? And if he asked for it, do you think there's any possibility that he would be given that sort of unilateral decision-making power over the team?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's sort of the – if they were to bring him in, they would probably give him complete control over the team, sort of what they did with Parcells
mm-hmm.
Back in the late 90s. That seems to be his biggest problem, his personality conflicts with the front office of San Francisco. But my guess is what would happen – is before the Jets interview hired John Idzik, one of the guys they interviewed was Tom Gamble, who was one of the higher personnel guys for San Francisco.
Yeah.
He's now with the Philadelphia Eagles in a sort of position under the general manager. My guess is if they were to bring in Jim Harbaugh, they would also hire Gamble, and he'd be sort of his connection to the Niners organization.
It would definitely be a big move to try and do something like that. But sometimes when you're stuck in a bit of a rut, you need to get a jolt to pull it out. And certainly hiring Jim Harbaugh and even giving mm-hmm. him that sort of power, it's the kind of thing that can really reinvigorate a fan base. And the Jets fan base is known for being a bit morose at times.
Yeah, that's absolutely why it's a move that absolutely screams Woody Johnson. It's the kind of thing he would definitely do to give the fans something, some of what they want, give them some of the blood that they've been screaming for. So I could absolutely see Woody Johnson pulling it off.
Do you think that's a wise move for the Jets? Is it smarter to go the Harbaugh route and just put all your eggs in the Jim Harbaugh basket, or is it wiser to keep Idzik and let Idzik run out his plan? Or mm-hmm. blow everything up? And I guess bringing in Harbaugh would count as blowing everything up, but it would mm-hmm. just be a sort of different – it would be a sort of one big sweeping move rather than just putting little pieces together.
I mean, it depends on the compensation for Harbaugh.
Sure.
If they're demanding a first-round pick because the Jets pick is going to be most likely in the top five,
right?
Then that's the kind of thing where you said putting all your eggs in one basket. If it doesn't work out with Harbaugh and you've lost a top five draft pick, that's the kind of move that sets your team back 4 more years at least.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think if that's what they're asking for, then it probably doesn't make much sense. If you can combine sort of some lower picks, maybe a second round pick and something else, maybe next year second pick around a pick or something like that, I think that it makes a lot more sense. But if you can get him for less than that, then, yeah, I think he's the kind of guy that, first of all, his personality would fit with what the kind of team that people have expected come to expect under Rex Ryan, this hard-nosed, smash-mouth team. I think he's the kind of person that can completely change your franchise's identity around I mean, he did it in San Francisco, he did it in Stanford.
Yeah.
So if they can get him for anything less than a straight first-round pick, then yeah, I think it's something they probably have to do.
Talking with Scott Salmon from Gang Green Nation right now on Sports Talk 1240. And that first-round pick is going to be very important, Scott, because if the Jets are looking for a new quarterback, it is, you know, not always the solution to pick a quarterback very high, but many times it has been shown that taking a quarterback, one of those top-tier, upper echelon guys, is sort of the path to success. Case in point, of course, Andrew Luck going to Indianapolis after Peyton Manning's injury season, and it was really just a one-year dip for the Colts, and now they're, you know, right back up contending year to year. So the top two guys at quarterback are Marcus Mariota from Oregon and, of course, Jameis Winston from Florida State. Now, if Mariota is off the board, whether he goes to, say, Tampa Bay or Oakland or anywhere that isn't the Jets, and the Jets come up, it's, you know, maybe fourth pick, fifth pick, sixth pick, whatever, and Winston is sitting there, knowing the New York media, knowing the so-called media circus that has surrounded the Jets for years since Rex Ryan has arrived, is it worth the risk, just that sort of, you know, that media risk, that media crush that Winston would face because of all the problems that he's faced during college, to come to the Jets and try and revitalize the franchise under whatever head coach, whatever regime is in place? Or do the Jets need a safer option than Jameis Winston?
Well, I don't know that the media concern is that. The media concern isn't actually what bothers me about Winston. I think if there's any quarterback that's equipped to just ignore the media, it's probably Winston.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of in a similar way to Manziel, he's sort of used to it. He's sort of blown it off for years. It doesn't really seem to faze him very much. I think I have more questions about him from an on-the-field perspective. And I think, for me personally, if you're taking a quarterback that high, if you're giving him a lot of money, you're probably investing the next, I'd say at least 3 years in him. And I wouldn't take a quarterback if I were the Jets that high that I have this many questions about as Winston. So I don't know that the media thing is as big a concern for me personally. If I were in the Jets organization, I think there are enough other on the field questions that you can have about him to be scared off.
That's completely fair. So if the Jets are looking to reset the quarterback position through the draft and Mariota is off the board and Winston isn't in the plan, is there one particular college guy that you would want the Jets to go after, like a Brett Hundley from UCLA, for example?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, as always, it depends with how the board falls.
Oh, of course.
If Hundley or Petty are available in the, let's say, fourth round, then I think one of those guys is probably worth a flyer. I'd probably take something like Petty over Hundley. The guy that I've been sort of had my eye on, late rounder Raheem Cato. I think he's someone to watch. Obviously, it's not until late round. Later round, so you're really not going to stake your future on him. But he's someone that could potentially develop into a franchise quarterback.
And it's not like the Jets have not had success with quarterbacks from Marshall before in their history.
Exactly. No, I think him coming out with the shades of Chad Pennington behind him would be, I think the fans would probably like that a lot.
Oh, absolutely. I guess one more question before I let you go. With John Idzik, he's really stressed controlling the cap, controlling the amount of money the Jets have been spending, and so they've got a bit of a surplus right now. The cornerback position, obviously in dire need of improvement. Running back is also a bit of an interesting situation. Of course, Chris Ivory has looked very good for the Jets, one of the best guys at getting yards after contact. Chris Johnson has been basically an absolute bust. They signed him for 2 years, but I really think he should be done after this one. He has nothing left in the tank. Bilal Powell, drafted 4 years ago, just never really caught on. And, of course, you know, the linebacking core for the Jets, while it does have very good pieces in DeMario Davis, Quinton Coples as that rush linebacker, Nick Ballore, the former mainstays, and David Harris, Calvin Pace, both getting up there in age. So with that extra money that the Jets have, Where would be the best place to throw some of that cash around in the free agency market, at running back, cornerback, or linebacker?
Well, it depends on what's going on with the head coach. If it's Rex Ryan that's still there, his entire system is predicated on the cornerbacks. And really, the linebackers aren't that important. That's why we really haven't seen him draft a linebacker at all or high up since he's taken over. So I think if we're talking Rex Ryan, the money's probably best found at cornerback. As you're seeing this draft, this year's running back class is what last year's wide receiver class was like. It's just incredibly filled with depth, and the team could probably get someone even later rounds that could if not a starter, then just a very good player behind Chris Ivory.
All right, last question, and just because I've got Twitter up, and this just came across, and I was reminded of it. Mark Sanchez is going to be a free agent after this season with the Philadelphia.
No,
absolutely no, completely done.
I think the problem was the. I'm trying to think of a way to word this. I think you mentioned this earlier that you think you guys sort of got a raw deal. I think that's probably true. I think just assuming it depends on who the staff is here. But there's so much that's gone wrong, that went wrong with him here. There are a lot of hard feelings between him and the team. I think with the current staff, the way it's formulated, and probably any future staff, I think it's too many bridges have been burnt. I think he needed that fresh start, and I don't think coming back to a much inferior system than what he has in Philadelphia is really going to do.
All right. Scott, thank you so much for joining me on the show tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. That was Scott Salmon. You can check him out at gangrenenation.com. Going to take a break. Coming up on the other side of the bottom of the hour, Mark Carrig, Mets writer for Newsday. Stay tuned to Sports Talk 1240.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB. Or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
And welcome back to Sports Talk 1240, last half hour of the two-hour block. Eric Garment here with you. We just had Scott Salmon on to talk some Jets football. Great stuff to talk about there with Scott. And now we're going to jump into some hot stove, and I'm going to bring on Mark Carrig, the New York Mets writer for Newsday. Mark, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So the hot stove is absolutely on fire this week. Josh Donaldson getting moved. Yasmani Tomas signing with Arizona. It has been a very busy month of November. A bunch of big names moving around. In addition to those two, of course, Michael Kadire signing with the Mets. Hanley Ramirez, Pablo Sandoval both going to the Red Sox. The big trade between the Cardinals and Braves. Jason Hayward heading to St. Louis. Shelby Miller going to Atlanta. And there are a lot of big names and mostly arms left on the market. Of course, Max Scherzer, John Lester, and James Shields, all still free agents. But, of course, we're going to focus on the Mets here tonight. And the Mets have some issues that they need to address before heading into next season. Mostly their surplus of major league quality starting pitching and the decision that needs to be made about the shortstop position. How can the Mets best use the pieces at their disposal to remain active this winter to set themselves up for a contending year in 2015?
Well, I think the biggest thing is to maximize, when they move one of these arms, whoever it may be, they've got to make the most of that deal. And, I guess, what I mean to say by that is basically if you trade one of them, they need to make sure that it's for a piece that can help him now. I don't think any of the veteran guys that are on that list, like the John Neeses, Bartolo Colon, Dylan Gies of the world, that's not going to get you a shortstop, but maybe that gets you something like a right-handed bench bat plus a lefty reliever or something to that effect. So, however they play it, I think the biggest thing for them is it looks like they're going to trade one of these arms, and when they do, you need to make the most of it. And I think specifically that means getting themselves a useful piece that will help fill a few of their needs. So, and again, probably won't be a shortstop. I don't think they're going to be willing to deal an arm that's significant enough to warrant getting a shortstop back, but certainly they can fill in other needs with what they've got on hand. So I think that's the biggest thing to watch for moving forward.
Absolutely. But as I mentioned, there are a lot of big-name pitchers still out on the free agent market, and even though some teams really aren't realistically in play for like a Lester or a Scherzer, it's still sort of dampening the market for those guys like Nice, G, and Colon that the Mets are trying to move at least one of. And some writers, both local and national, have suggested that it may have been too long of a wait that the Mets took to move either G or Nice. Is there any sort of situation that you see that the Mets somehow managed to not move one of those three guys, or potentially a different guy like a DeGrom or a Wheeler in a more blockbuster-style trade? And how do you think they would address a situation of not making any moves and having really eight or nine starting pitchers and needing to pare that down to a rotation?
Well, I guess we'll work backwards. Obviously, someone's going to end up in the bullpen.
Sure.
That's clear. If they're in that scenario, which I don't think is really likely, but if they are, I think Dylan G is a bullpen guy, and at least, and then now you start investigating different options that way. As far as trading more a sexier arm, so to speak, that only happens if somebody like Starlin Castro is actually on the market, and that hasn't happened to this point, as far as I can tell anyway. I mean, I know there's a lot of talk linking the Mets to a guy like Starlin Castro, but the bottom line is the Chicago Cubs, at least right now, are playing it like they want to win now.
Absolutely.
And what team that's trying to win now is going to trade the only guy in their organization that's been an everyday high-impact shortstop? So, yeah, they've got prospects, but, prospects aren't three-time All-Stars. They aren't guys who have led the league in hits. Well, they've got that guy already. He's pretty young. So, until they have a change of thinking there, then, I just, for all of the speculation about trying to trade for a shortstop, there isn't one on the market right now that I think the Mets consider someone that's worth pulling the trigger and putting some of those bigger pieces in play. And then as far as, the market being dampened, I don't think the market is dampened. I think it's slowing. Mm-hmm. It's slowed. I think it's a matter of timing. You know, I know there's been lots of reports about, you know, what the Mets are going to do with those pitchers. And, you know, my sense of it so far is that they haven't gone out and shopped any of those guys particularly hard. But I think once this market starts to define itself, and right now it hasn't as far as the pitching side goes, but once it starts to do that, I think you get a clearer picture of what might actually happen until then. And when you're in the position that the Mets are in, you know, you can't really do anything but wait. So, you know, I think, well, obviously they'd be ready to go if it came to that. I think they're certainly willing to deal, especially those veteran guys.
Sure.
I think they've done the prep work to put themselves in position to do that. And I think it's way too early to sit here and say it's too late, I think. You know, maybe that conversation changes, you know, after a month and some dominoes have fallen and we have a clearer picture. But I don't know. Until then, I think really this is just a matter of, you know, playing a waiting game and you know, and then assessing what the landscape actually looks like. But you know, that's a pretty impossible thing to do, I think, when, you know, nothing's really happened yet on that front.
That's true, and that's completely fair. And to be fair to Sandy Alderson, he has done a very good job of waiting for the right deal to really materialize before pulling the trigger. A couple seasons ago, moving John Buck and Marlon Byrd and bringing Dilson Herrera back, and Herrera trying to entrench himself as the second baseman of the future, although Daniel Murphy currently stands in the way of that, and then making the move on Ike Davis this past April when it really seemed like the market for whichever Mets first baseman, either Davis or Duda, it absolutely seemed like a move was going to happen over this past winter. Nothing came, and he waited and waited and waited and got the right deal that he wanted, pulled the trigger. So maybe he's, you know, lying dormant again, just waiting for it to pop up. You talked about shortstops and how really high name guys like Starlin Castro and also Troy Tulowitzki, of course, his name has been brought up a lot in trade talks. Don't really seem to be on the market. But the next step down, whether there are guys that are kind of in the more waning stages of their career, like Alexei Ramirez, or still possess a lot of upside, like Brad Miller from Seattle, or Chris Owings or Didi Gregorius from Arizona, do any of those four guys seem kind of like a better fit or a more likely acquisition than any of the rest of them? Or is it all just sort of, you know, kind of a wait-and-see moment right now?
I think it's more the latter. I think it's certainly a wait-and-see because, you know, all those guys you mentioned, you know, they don't, I don't think any of them really check all the boxes, so to speak.
Right.
So, not like the Mets are sitting there ready to put, like, a Jake DeGrom in a deal to get most of the guys you just listed off.
Right.
So, I think it's a certainly wait-and-see situation. You know, this thing has the potential to drag on for a while. And, you know, I think if I were a fan, I would, at this point, that's what I'd expect. And that's because, you know, this free agent class at shortstop, you know, they don't really knock, you don't bowl you over. I think they all have some warts that everybody can see. But the flip side of that is, you know, if that ends up, you know, affecting how people pursue them, it really is not like a difficult scenario to see that maybe one or more of these guys come January doesn't have a place to be yet. And if that's the case, all of a sudden the calculus on how you evaluate those players changes, because instead of weighing whether somebody's worth a multi-year deal, which of course carries a lot of risk,
sure,
maybe it now becomes a matter of, hey, maybe someone will play for 1 year
right
here, or maybe, I mean, not much more than that. All of a sudden that becomes you know, something that enters the realm of where the Mets can compete for a player like that. Not to say that will happen, just saying that when you look at what it is right this second, I don't think it's crazy to think that it's possible. So, you know, at the same time, if you're the Mets, you know, you're constantly monitoring the trade market because things can change. But I think they've got a pretty, you know, just from my understanding, talking to people in the organization, they seem to have a pretty solid grasp, they feel, on what's out there and what's actually, you know, realistically possible. But at the same time, we saw, as you mentioned at the top here, with Boston and their acquisitions, you know, there's some question about whether a guy like Xander Bogaerts, you know, fits into their long-term plans. And right now, that's what it looks like. But certainly, That's an example where, hey, maybe that shifts. You know, maybe Henley can't hack it in left field. And now you've got, to put him back in the infield somewhere, most likely shortstop. Maybe that's not ideal, but I don't know. Maybe there's a situation where the Henley's forced that way. Now all of a sudden, here's this commodity that wasn't available, before and is now. So I think if you're the Mets, this is something I get, they're going to have to basically be ready to pounce on an opportunity like that if it comes up. But right now, you can't really assume that it's going to come up either, because unlike, signing a free agent, which isn't as easy as, basically saying, I want X player and then making it happen, trades take multiple parties to come together. And that means that timelines aren't necessarily within the team's control either. So I think that all that stuff that we talked about here, that's sort of the recipe for the waiting game that looks like they're going to be in here for a while.
Yeah, and early on in the offseason when there were rumors and reports that the Red Sox weren't entirely enamored with Yoenis Cespedes, a lot of people were trying to pair up the Mets and Red Sox on all sorts of potential deals centered around Cespedes coming to Queens for 1 year. But you mentioned Hanley Ramirez set to play the outfield. On the press release for the Hanley Ramirez signing, it did say left fielder. But there was a wonder, a bit of an inkling, if it was sort of a smokescreen, if they're still working on potentially moving Bogarts and trying to get a left-handed pitcher in return, because that's something that Boston could definitely use. There have been rumors that John Neese could be of interest to Boston. Someone else, maybe Cole Hamels, could be of interest to Boston. So do you think that, especially because they've got so many outfielders and nowhere near enough room to play all of them, is Hanley Ramirez really the left fielder for the Boston Red Sox, or is he the left fielder for the Boston Red Sox if they don't move Xander Bogarts?
I don't know why you would move Xander Bogarts. If you're any team that's in contention or wants to be in contention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? And then you're also in position to buy players. Why wouldn't you just buy the players and keep your assets?
That's a completely fair point. Of course, the Red Sox are doing their inquiry on Lester. They're getting some fight back from the Giants, from the Cubs, from the Braves. And that's all really going to shake out over the next couple of weeks. I think by the time the winter meetings are done, some big contracts are going to be flying around.
I know that Xander Bogaerts' name gets tossed around a lot as maybe being moved in the scenario you described, but still, I don't know what the motivation would be if you're in a position like Boston where you can address those needs without parting with any more of your own assets you've already got in-house. And it's not like it's really easy to find a guy like Bogaerts who's got all that offensive upside. While he's certainly far from perfect at that position, you can at least see him being there for a little bit before having to move him off. There's just not that many of those guys around.
No.
So, and especially for them when, hey, if you decide that you're going to just start writing checks, all of a sudden you're one of those lucky few teams that has the wherewithal financially to just go ahead and, add to your talent base without having to deplete it in a trade.
And Boston really throwing the money around, of course, making the two big free agent acquisitions. They're really trying to just go hills and valleys right now. They had the valley hit the big hill, winning the World Series 2013, bottomed out again, and now they're trying to climb back up that mountain. So I just wanted to get back to the Mets rotation. Of course, you think that the Mets are going to end up moving one of those veteran starters, whether it be Neese, G, or Cologne. Matt Harvey coming back. There's Noah Syndergaard, but he's kind of more off in the distance, unless he incredibly impresses during spring training, and I don't even think that's enough. He'll still almost certainly start next year in AAA alongside the up-and-down Rafael Montero. So as of right now, right here at the end of November, if you had to pick the five guys who are going to be in that Mets opening day rotation come April 2015, who do you project as being in there?
Well, it's Harvey, Wheeler, DeGrom.
Absolutely.
I would say right off the top. But I guess it gets kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But, I think of the pitchers that gets moved, I could see, Neese followed by Cologne being those guys, because I think I mean, there's got to be teams that will be comfortable taking on the risk of Nice just because his contract is so team-friendly. You know, and I know there are teams that value him as a really solid middle rotation guy, even teams that are, you know, playoff contenders, I think. You know, just talking to other executives and talent evaluators, I think he's highly regarded, you know, in that role. And so I think if they move somebody, he'd certainly have lots of appeal to other clubs. So I guess I'd round it out with Bartolo and Dylan G for now. You know, and I would agree with you unless, you know, Syndergaard just goes out and has a lights out spring. You know, I think he ends up back in Vegas. I mean, not for long, probably, but, you know, good to see that scenario unfolding. But, yeah, I guess those would be my five. It's so funny because when people ask me this, I always forget an arm or two just because there's so many of them.
Yeah, it's a great problem to have, but a good problem to have is still a problem that you have, and it's something they need to address.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, though. You know, yes and no, in a weird way, just because, and I think the Mets are a great example of this. We've seen what happens when you talk about a surplus of pitching.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody gets hurt. Pitchers get hurt. Pitchers endure wild swings in performances. You know, oftentimes that's, you know, there's an injury, you know, underlying those kinds of issues. So, you know, it's the oldest cliche ever, but, I mean, you really can't have enough, you know, major league ready starting pitching, especially now. We've seen, you know, how many teams have been really impacted by it. You know, and even the Mets, you know, like, they, you know, their issues this year, weren't necessarily the pitching. You know, and that's even after losing Matt Harvey. So, I mean, you know, that alone should be a pretty easy reminder to folks about the importance of depth. You know, certainly you only have so many spots, and you know, you want to be able to, you know, maximize your resources, you know, and certainly having a guy who should be starting, you know, in the major leagues and having him pitch out of the bullpen and, you know, a long reliever, that's not the best use of resources, especially, well, even in the case of a guy like Dylan G. I mean, that's a $4 million long reliever. It's not a really smart use of resources. So in that regard, certainly, you know, they'd be motivated to try to, you know, put that money, put that spot to better use. But at the same time, you know, I don't know if it would be, like, an absolute the worst scenario ever if, you know, they end up starting the year with these guys. I think that makes, you know, it could make it harder to trade. But you know, I feel like pitching is one of those things, even now when, you know, there's a lot of it, there's still always going to be a need for it somewhere, especially at the rates that these guys are playing for right now. You know, these are pretty decent prices for guys who, you know, have at the very least shown that they belong, you know, in the major leagues.
Talking with Mark Carrig, Mets writer for Newsday right now. I was talking to a friend of mine about this problem that the Mets have with the starting pitching, and of course they are getting Matt Harvey back, but Harvey is coming off the Tommy John surgery. And his suggestion, and I'm not sure if this is really even feasible, just the way that schedules work, but his suggestion was to pitch Rafael Montero on the same days as Matt Harvey. So if you ever wanted to give Harvey, have him skip a start or give him a day off if he really needs it, you could just call Montero up and pitch him on the same schedule. And is that something that has any sort of, you know, plausibility of working, especially with the AAA club being so far away in Las Vegas? Or is that something that maybe kind of works a little bit if you really need it to?
Yeah, I don't, you know, with a thing like that, I think that affects too many different schedules. You know, having to rearrange Montero or really designating anybody to have to do something like that. And it also doesn't take into account if something goes wrong.
Right.
As you mentioned, the travel aspect of it can get tricky depending, you know. Actually, it's not as bad when they're in Vegas because at least there's direct flights typically to major league cities from Vegas. But,
right,
you know, it's a little bit different when you're trying to get a flight out of Albuquerque. So, you know, there's certainly going to be some of the logistic issues at play. But also, you know, you're trying to develop players at the level below. And I feel like, you know, just, you know, listening to that scenario, this is one of those things where I would say that it's more likely that it just sort of, you know, they might try to line somebody up kind of like that, but they've got to be fluid too. So, you know, just to guard against, you know, scenario where, hey, maybe Montero's not very effective. You know, maybe that guy you designated has a couple starts where they get roughed up. I mean, do you want to call that guy up in the major leagues, or do you want to have the flexibility to adjust on the fly? You know, so I would think, you know, just for the people I've talked to in the organization, I think they're going to have, you know, a pretty reasonably, you know, straightforward plan with Harvey. I think they're going to know what spots they can pick, and the schedule allows them to do that. You know, there's going to be off days that they can, you know, sort of use to extend time between starts. You know, I feel like, you know, there's a pretty good chance we'll see a bunch of spot starts from different guys this year just because, you know, calling someone up in the minors won't, you know, disrupt the rotation, you know, just in the same way that you would if you were to bump Harvey like a day or two back. And then that, of course, has, you know, could have a chain reaction as far as everybody else's schedule. So I would say, you know, the first part of that's right. I think we'll see some spot starts, guys getting promoted, come up and take a start from Harvey. But, you know, I don't know. I'd have a harder time envisioning someone being designated to be that guy, just because of the flexibility issue. And like you mentioned, you know, the schedule part of this gets tricky too.
Right. And maybe that's why you keep someone like Dylan G around as a long man, and you can throw him, you know, if you really need to, you can just throw him in if he's feeling a little sore, or if you want to, you know, have him skip a start. Maybe you keep someone like Dylan G on the roster to be sort of that relief that Harvey could need as the season goes on. Switching gears, for the second time now since Citi Field has opened, the Mets are currently adjusting the dimensions of the outfield, most notably the right center field fence this time. And the dimensions will eventually, once the new wall is all finally put together, it will sort of resemble that, actually, of Shea Stadium. It won't be perfect, but it'll be sort of like it in a way. When he was talking about the new dimension, Sandy Alderson said there would have been 27 extra home runs total hit in Citi Field if the new dimensions were in place, and 17 of them would have been from the Mets. Lucas Duda obviously got to 30 home runs last year. Curtis Granderson got to 20, and those are two of the three guys, the other being, of course, David Wright, who is coming off a very unfortunate year, just really had a down year, so of course had the shoulder problems, couldn't get his swing right. Do you see a real uptick in power numbers at home for Duda, for Granderson, and does the change in right center field help you know, rejuvenate David Wright offensively and help him shoot for that right center field gap more like he did earlier in his career?
Yeah, I doubt that it helps with Wright's power numbers. If I recall, if he didn't have any last year that went that way, that would have been homers. But, like, I mean, there's a bigger point to be made here. And you mentioned the 27 home runs that were additional. You know what? There's nobody on earth that can predict whether that stays in the Mets advantage 17-10, you know, as it was last year. There's just no telling. There's no predicting, you know, whether the 9 home runs that Granderson would have had last year, you can automatically add that to the ledger for 2015. Because the fact of the matter is, the park is, you know, going to play a little bit tighter, and you're probably going to see more home runs. You know, to try to call the distribution of those and to even say it's an advantage for the Mets, you know, is like trying to determine how many hits a guy is going to finish with. It's just, there's, I mean, honestly, there's no telling. So what I think is a better way to look at this equation is the Mets have made a calculated decision that playing in a ballpark that is friendlier to home run hitters, particularly left-handed home run hitters, is going to be advantageous to them moving forward. That's not to say that, you know, there's nobody in that front office that's sitting there thinking, oh, we can predict how many balls are gonna, how many more balls are going to fly out of here for, you know, for their hitters. There's just no telling. But and I certainly think you're going to see more home runs. But to predict like whether they actually benefit the Mets or not, that's kind of impossible. I don't think the changes were made with that in mind per se. I think the changes were made because in general they think a park that permits more home runs is something they can better take advantage of. And, you know, Sandy Alderson talked a lot about how they didn't really do this for the benefit of a single player, but I think clearly a guy like Curtis Granderson, who again had 9 home runs, would have had 9 more home runs had they had these fences in for this season. So I think it clearly benefits him. And I think the thing that's kind of interesting about this is, you would think that bringing those fences in would be a really, detrimental thing for pitchers, and certainly this doesn't help them. But I think the Mets believe that they're better positioned to handle that, just because they have a pitching staff that strikes guys out and also keeps the ball out of the air, generally speaking. So it's interesting, though. It's one of the things that I'm looking forward to sort of seeing how it unfolds next season, and not so much let's count up how many we would have had, but more so just the complexion of the games and how the games actually play.
All right, Mark, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show tonight.
All right, you got it, man.
All right, that was Mark Carrick, Mets writer for Newsday. Thanks also to Scott Salmon from Gangrene Nation for coming on the show. Thanks to Brian Graves on the other side of the glass. Hope you all have a great December and a fantastic holiday season. Thank you for tuning in to Sports Talk 1240. I'm Eric Garment.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.